Well, thank you. So how many of you know a psycholinguist? That's pretty good. So in general, psycholinguistics is not interested necessarily in engineering applications, but is interested in figuring out how people process language. That is, we're interested in finding out what are the computations that people use when they're processing and using language. And specifically, I do cognitive modeling of psycholinguistics, and in that case, we're aiming to formalize the computations that people are using when they're processing language in order to better understand and in order to make predictions that might be helpful for people working with language disorders or normal, typical or atypical development, or just, you know, how people looking at how we can best make the environment such that people can process speech well. So in building models of how people process language, there are a couple of types of data that we can use to constrain those models. And one is pretty common in the psycholinguistic modeling literature, and that is experimental data. So I'm not sure if anyone here comes from a psychology background, but if you did, you would be very familiar with this type of data. What happens is we bring people into the lab and we ask them to perform tasks. So for example, we might play them a sound and ask them what that sound is, or we might play two sounds and ask the person whether those sounds are the same or different. Or, you know, in a language experiment, we might play them a sentence and ask them if it's a grammatical. And that's the kind of data that we can collect in the lab, and that's pretty well known in fields like cognitive psychology. And in general, psycholinguistic models or models of the types of processes that people use when they're processing language aim to capture this type of psycholinguistic data. And you can think of that as, you know, constraining the output of the model. That is, if we build a model of how people process language, we want to know that when the model is put in a laboratory setting, that it has the same kind of output that people have when people are put in a laboratory setting. Right, so we'd like to have the models make predictions that are similar to experimental data. But there's another type of data that you all are much more familiar with than the psychologists, and that is corpus data. And in general, corpus data is used much less than psycholinguistic data in constraining cognitive models, but it really should be. In that what we'd like to do is to be able to put the models in an ecologically valid setting. And in that ecologically valid setting, we want the models to perform in the same way that humans would. And so if we can put a model into an ecologically valid setting and then have it produce the same kind of data that humans do in an experiment, then that would be evidence that we've got the right model of how people are processing language. And of course, in the speech domain, these correspond to speech corpora, which many of you are very familiar with, and perceptual data from psycholinguistic tasks. And in particular, if we think of this as the input and the output of a model, then that corresponds to sort of what goes into and out of a perceiver. So if we think of a perceiver, I'm going to assume Bayes' rule is okay. So if we think of a perceiver who's, let's say, trying to extract something from a speech signal, the experimental data are going to be sort of tell us what they think the speech signal was after they heard that speech. And the corpus data are going to give us what they expect to hear in general when they hear speech around them. So if we formalize this in a Bayesian framework, then we can think of these as constraining the posterior and the prior, respectively. And so despite the fact that both of these types of data seem to be really important for constraining cognitive models, at least on the speech side, not so true on the language side, there's been very little use of speech corpora in building cognitive models. So speech is messy, it's hard to deal with, we don't really know how to do speaker, I mean, certainly as psycholinguists don't really know how to do speaker normalization. We don't really know how to do dialect normalization. There are a lot of hard problems that we would need to solve in order to be able to use these data. I'm hoping we can move in that direction, and what I'm going to try and show you today is a speech perception model that we actually developed in order to match perceptual data. And I'm going to show you how we think we can extend it to work from speech corpora. And so This is interesting on a cognitive modeling side because we're constraining our model from both sides, but I think it's also interesting on a speech recognition side because this model in the middle here provides a formal link between what you can measure in corpora and what you can measure in the lab, and so we can start to think about how to use data from the lab to constrain models of speech recognition. Many of you are probably not familiar with the type of behavioral data that I'll be talking about, so I'm going to go through that first, and then show you the cognitive model that was originally built to capture data from the lab, and then show you how we can start to implement that model on speech corpora and give you a few pilot results that are actually very much work in progress. So the basic finding that we'll be talking about is the idea that categories affect perception. So what do I mean by categories? I mean categories of sounds like stop consonants, fricatives, liquids, vowels, and so on. And we can see these kinds of effects all over cognition, but today we'll be focusing on speech. So let's take an example of how we would test something like this in the lab, so the effect of categories on perception. So we can take, let's say, one class of sound categories like stop consonants. This is ba and pa, so those are two different kinds of stop consonants. They differ along a feature called voicing, which acoustically is characterized by something called voice onset time. And by manipulating this acoustic parameter, we can create a continuum of sounds ranging from ba to pa. And we can actually, you know, start with a ba and a pa and synthesize sounds in the middle so that some of them are intermediate between ba and pa acoustically. And then we can bring people into the lab and play them those sounds and see what they say. So one question we could ask people in the lab would be, play them a single sound and ask, what is that sound? Is it a ba or a pa? Right? All of them sound sort of like ba's and pa's, but some are in the middle. And if you play them a good ba, they'll say the sound sounds like ba. And if you play them a good pa, they'll say the sound sounds like pa. So here on this axis is the percentage of time that they respond pa. So it's 0 for ba and 100% for pa. And then if you play them sounds in the middle, what they'll do is they'll say ba, 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 ba until they hit what's called the category boundary, and then they'll say pa, 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 pa. Right? So we can, everything to the left of this is ba, and everything to the right of this is pa. Another thing, and so we'll call that an identification function. It's telling us how people identify these sounds. Another thing we can do is we can bring people into the lab and play them two sounds at a time from this continuum and ask them whether those sounds are the same or different. If we pick two sounds that straddle this category boundary, typically people will say different. If we pick two sounds on the same side of the category boundary, typically people will say same. And so if we plot the percentage of time that people say different to each pair of sounds, then we get this discrimination function that has a peak at the category boundary where people are saying different a lot, and it's very low within categories, at least for stop consonants. And this is known as categorical perception. So essentially, it's almost as though people only heard which category the sound belonged to, and then made their discrimination decision based on those labels. Right? The story is a little bit different for vowels, though. There's still a peak in discrimination at the category boundary, but within category discrimination is much higher, so here we can't say that people are only labeling those vowels. They're clearly hearing the differences between, say, this vowel and this vowel because they have very high discrimination ability.
But along the x-axis, at least acoustically, it's the same number of gradients.
That's right. So this is an equally spaced acoustic continuum. Either along a voice onset time scale, so in milliseconds of voice onset time, which is just an acoustic parameter.
It looks like the boundary, people are much more sensitive
to differences. That's right. Yeah, oh, I forgot to say, please, I have often talked to psychology and linguistics audiences. I've much less often talked to computer science audiences and engineering audiences, so please interrupt me if any of the psycholinguistics is not clear. I'm happy to answer questions. So we see this difference between consonants and vowels. It's the same sort of effect. So these are qualitatively similar. It almost seems like, you know, if there's a pa category and a ba category or an e category and a category, equally spaced stimuli will be sort of biased in perception toward the center of that category, so they're harder to discriminate near that center of the category. But actually, these have been talked about in consonants and vowels as two different effects. So in stop consonants, people have talked about categorical perception, such that you perceive what category a sound belongs to, and then you sort of ignore all the other information about that sound. Whereas in vowels, people have talked about a perceptual magnet, where perception is pulled toward the prototype of a category or the center of a category, and that's why you get this slightly reduced discriminability near the center of a category. Yes? I'm about to argue that. I'm about to argue that to you. So actually, this model that we've developed was, again, originally meant to capture these behavioral data that we get in the lab. And so it provides a unified explanation for these strong and weak categorical effects in a computational framework. So this is work by my student Yaakov Kronrad and former student Emily Kappas. And my graduate advisor is Tom Griffiths and Jim Morgan. And the basic idea is that we think that listeners are perceiving speech in a noisy channel framework. But this is going to be a slightly different noisy channel framework than most of you have heard of before. So let me go through it in a little bit of detail. So we've got a speaker and a listener, and the listener is going to try and figure out what the speaker said. So that much is familiar. And so the way that speakers are going to produce sounds is that first they'll choose a category to say, and we'll call that C for category. And you know that's something that should be pretty familiar. But then the speaker is going to do something that speakers don't usually do in speech perception models. That is, the speaker is going to articulate a particular acoustic value from that category. And we're going to call that a target production. So why this particular acoustic value? Well, the speaker might be wanting to let the listener know something about upcoming sounds, so they'll be co-articulating. Or they might have some indexical information about who they are, or maybe what their mood is, or what their dialect is, or so on. So there's a whole range of variability that could be within a category. And what we're saying is some of that is actually meaningful for a listener to recover. That is, the specific acoustic value that a speaker produces is going to carry information that a listener might want. So that is, a listener doesn't only care about perceiving what category the sound was from, they also care about recovering the particular acoustic value that the speaker said from that category, because it might carry information that they might want to recover. So we're going to call that acoustic value a target production, and that's now a continuous value, and that's what the listener is going to try and infer in our model. There's some noise in the speech signal. And the listener hears a speech sound. So now the noise is changing one acoustic value, so one continuous value, to another continuous value. And so this is slightly different than flipping bits in a noisy channel, but it's the same idea. So here it is in math. We're going to choose a category with some prior. We're going to then articulate a target production. And for right now, these categories are Gaussian, centered around some category mean. Mu sub c with some category variance, sigma c squared. And this is meaningful variance, so it contains information that a listener might want to recover. Then the listener is going to hear a speech sound that's normally distributed around that target production with some noise variance, sigma s squared for speech signal noise. And that's going to be the data with which they try and denoise that signal. So in pictures, a speaker is going to choose a phonetic category, sample a target production from that category. There's some speech signal noise, and the listener is going to hear a speech sound. And so in terms of inferring what the target was, the listener knows what speech sound they heard because they heard it. And they know the phonetic categories of their language because they're presumably a native speaker of that language. And they know the amount of speech signal noise, and if you have questions about that, we can talk about it later. So what they need to infer is which target production the speaker intended. In a Bayesian framework, they're using the data that they hear in the speech to decide between hypotheses about what the target production was, and they're guided by their prior distribution over the targets that speakers might want to say in their language, and the likelihood, which is the probability of hearing that speech sound given any target that a speaker might have produced. Okay, so how do they do this? This is how you set up Bayes' rule for inferring a target given a sound, given this framework. So the prior is in red here. It's the phonetic categories of the language. It gives high probability to sounds near category centers. And the likelihood is in blue, so that's the speech signal noise. It gives high probability to targets that are similar to the speech sound that a listener heard. And what a listener needs to do in order to compute this posterior over targets is to, at each point, multiply these two curves together. When they do that, they get a posterior distribution. In this case, it's a mixture of two Gaussians because there were two categories in this fake language. And so here on the left is the Gaussian that would have resulted if the sound came from the category on the left. And so in math, we see that it's a weighted average. So if we take the mean of that Gaussian, it's a weighted average between the speech sound that a listener heard and the mean of the phonetic category. And the speech sound is weighted by the meaningful category variance. That is, if there's, yes or no, if there's a lot of meaningful variability in the category, then a listener pays a lot of attention to the speech sound because it actually carries information. Whereas the mean of the phonetic category is weighted by the amount of speech signal noise. So if there's a lot of noise, then listeners are relying a lot on prior information. And so the same thing for the category on the right. This is now a mixture of Gaussians, and each one is weighted by the probability that the sound came from that category. So this is just the mean of the posterior that you get when you solve this Gaussian inference problem. And so what it says is that if listeners are trying to optimally infer an acoustic value that a speaker intended, then perception of unambiguous sounds will be pulled toward category means. And if the sound could have come from either category, it'll be pulled in both directions. And so if we just look at the mean of the posterior, those will cancel out. And so we get exactly this type of picture where sounds near the centers of categories are close together. Sounds between categories are actually farther apart, and that's because of this competing influence of two different categories. And so we get exactly this effect where, as we move out toward the boundary between categories, sound differences get easier to perceive. So under this account, categorical effects should arise because listeners are using their knowledge of their language to try and infer what a speaker said, but they're trying to infer the continuous detail, and that's what's leading to these categorical effects. That is, these categorical effects occur because most speakers say things near the centers of phonetic categories, so what else should a listener hear? Okay, so this makes a couple of predictions. So one is that this weighting of the sound and the mean of the phonetic category is governed by the ratio of category meaningful variance to speech signal noise. And so if we mess with that ratio, we should be able to mess with how categorical people are perceiving things. How categorically people are perceiving things. So we did that. So in low noise conditions, we should expect perception to be veridical. In high noise conditions, we should expect perception to be more biased toward category centers or more categorical. And so we actually tested that in a noise experiment. So these are two dimensions along which vowels differ. This is the first formant and the second formant. If you don't know what those are, don't worry. They're just two dimensions. These are 13 stimuli in the part of vowel space that corresponds roughly to E and A. And so we can synthesize these vowels and play them to listeners. And what we did was to give listeners an AX discrimination task, and this was modeled on a previous experiment by Iverson and Kuhl, where listeners heard all ordered pairs of stimuli and determined whether sounds were identical. They heard them two at a time. So some listeners heard them in quiet listening conditions. And some heard them in noisy listening conditions. And what we wanted to know was whether they would behave more categorically when there was more noise in the speech signal that they were listening to. Yeah. Mm-hmm. What is an AX discrimination task? Right. You hear two sounds. The first sound is A. The second sound is X. The question is X the same as A, or is X something else, like B? Right. So listeners would hear something like, and then they would have to say same or different. Thank you. Other things that I forgot to say? Okay. So when we do this experiment, we get out a confusion matrix of how often people say same to each pair of stimuli. So this would be, you played stimulus one twice, and 98% of the time people said, almost 100% of the time people said it was the same sound, and they were right. Here you played one versus two, and 82% of the time they said it was the same, but in this case they were wrong. It was actually one and two. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I wonder myself, I'm sort of somehow deep in my head, because when I listen to speech, I don't think I'm forced to choose.
Whether two sounds are the same or different?
Yes, or what the sound is in general. So I think if I can't make a decision, I just kind of sleep it under the carpet and wait longer.
So one thing to note is that actually listeners are, in the experiment, they never have to identify these sounds. So the question is not, is this an E or an A? In fact, they never have to give that answer or identify the categories of any of these sounds. All they're saying is same or different to a pair of stimuli. So the effects of categories that we see are going to be not because they gave category responses in the experiment, but they're going to be because somehow in their heads they're using the categories to constrain what they hear. And whether forced choices are the right ways to run experiments is probably a no, but everyone does it. Yeah. Other questions? Okay, so this is the kind of matrix we get out. Like, this would be 1 versus 13. You know, this would be 6 versus 9, and so on. It's kind of hard to see what effects we have in this kind of a format, so I'm going to show you heat maps. But it's exactly the same format. So this is 1 versus 1, this is 1 versus 2, this is 1 versus 13, and so on. And black means that people said... I do, but not in this presentation. That's right. So the boundary is right around here. It's not exactly in the middle. These guys all sound like E-E-E-E-E-A-A. But I'm happy to play them for you, but maybe after. Yeah. They are all the same length. One does happen before the other, and that may be an issue, but we didn't look at asymmetries here.
So here we discussed it before, but maybe you have a different answer.
Uh-oh.
I suspect that since the more heavy bias towards E noise is because of this strong concentration of energy around second and third and fourth format, which kind of probably sticks out of
yeah.
the noise. And I wonder if
No, we haven't. Actually, I really want it. So, no, that's okay. But that's why I do want to run more experiments like this. And in particular, we've talked about synthesizing the sounds actually to match speech corpora. So if we were able to do that, then I think we could use a wider range of stimuli. And I would very much like to do that. Yeah, so, so what do you see here? So first of all, people are saying same when they're same in both the no noise and the noise condition. They're saying different when they're very different, so that's good. They're making a couple of mistakes over here when there's a lot of noise. The next thing you can see is that they're saying same more often in the noise condition than the no noise condition. That's because it's noisy. The third thing you can see is that actually they're not the same, they're not performing the same all along this continuum. So up here, if you go along the diagonal, it's darker and then lighter and then darker again. And so that means that they're having more trouble discriminating sounds near the category endpoints, which is exactly what we think there are in categorical effects. So we've now replicated these categorical effects. You can kind of see it in the curviness of this black. And it's actually much more curvy, so that effect is stronger in the noise condition. So we think we're seeing effects where in the no noise condition, perception is less categorical, and in the noise condition, perception is more categorical, and that's exactly what we were hoping for, because that's exactly what we had predicted. And so we can test whether the model captures this by just running a simulation where we assume that a listener is sitting in an experiment. We assume that they hear the first sound and sample a target production from their posterior on what the speaker might have said. For that sound. There's no speaker here. It's actually in an experiment, but we assume that this is the way that people are perceiving sounds anyway. They hear the second sound and sample a target from that posterior. And then they compare the two targets, that distance between them, to a threshold. And if that distance is greater than the threshold, they say different. If it's less than the threshold, they say same. And so in that way, we can predict. So by looking at how often this distance is going to be below a threshold, then we can predict how often they're going to say same to any pair of stimuli. right? So that's a model that we can use, but now we have to actually fit the parameters that we're using in this model. One thing we can do is fit some parameters to identification data. That is, when listeners say what a sound was. So if we fit an identification curve, what we're able to fit are the means of the categories and the combined variance, that is the noise plus the category variance. There are two means. Actually, for the vowels, we simulated it with equal variances on the two categories. One speech signal noise and one threshold. That's right. Yeah, that's exactly right. So here we're getting two means. Well, we have to set one of the means, otherwise it's not identifiable. But after fitting the identification data, we get out two means and the sum of these variances, but we don't have the threshold and we don't have the difference between the noise and category variance, which tells us how categorical something is going to be. Then we can fit the discrimination data, and here we're able to separate out the effects of the speech signal noise and the category variance, and we can also fit that threshold. So we did that. We had two free parameters on actually fitting these discrimination data. So these were the model fits. The speech signal noise did come out to be the best fitting value was higher in the noise condition than the no-noise condition, so that's good. The threshold was also bigger in the noise condition. That's probably just because it was harder to hear differences, but we do replicate this higher curviness in the noise condition. This model is accounting for differences in noise. What that means is we've just made vowels look more like consonants just by adding noise. Actually, Yaakov and Emily, my students at the time, saw that and said, well, maybe this can actually work for consonants. So maybe consonants are just like vowels, but, you know, with more perceptual noise and less meaningful variance. What they did was to actually fit the model to similar discrimination data from stop consonants and fricatives. They looked at, when they fit the discrimination data, again, one of the free parameters was how much of that variance is meaningful versus noise. That's reflected in how categorical things are. I'm not going to show you the fits. They were pretty good. But I am going to show you this ratio that they derived for each of the kinds of sounds. So for vowels, this was what I just showed you. This is the no-noise condition. This is a weak effect of categories. It had a much higher category variance than noise variance. These are the parameters that they got for fitting different consonants. In these simulations, they were not assuming equal variance. This model was built to capture data from the lab, and it did, in fact, capture data from a range of sounds. It captured data from a couple different noise conditions, correctly predicted that perception should be more biased in noisy conditions. It provides a way to capture this difference between strong categorical effects in consonants and weak categorical effects in vowels with the same model, just changing this single parameter that's mediating between how much of this variance listeners are trying to recover from the signal. So far, this model has only used one kind of data, right? So it predicted perceptual data, but actually in fitting these parameters, we also used perceptual data. What we did to fit the parameters was we looked at identification curves and we figured out what people's means and variances inside their head would have to be in order to generate those identification curves. And so really we're not making use of anything ecologically valid at all. Right. That's not actually limited to us. Many cognitive models have this weakness. What I'm going to try and show you now is a way that we can actually fix that, so that instead of having only connections to laboratory data, we can start having connections to corpus data. The method that we're going to use for adapting this to speech corpora was developed jointly with Leishi and Tom Griffiths and Adam Sanborn. And actually, when we were developing this, we weren't thinking about speech at all. We were just thinking about sort of an interesting way of implementing Bayesian inference. But it turns out to be a method that's very useful for applying this to speech. When we think about wanting to use speech corpora, what we'd like to do is to be able to use the distributions of sounds in speech corpora as a prior in our model. That is, listeners have gone around the world hearing speech all their lives, and we've captured a sample of that speech by recording these speech corpora. And so this should be something like what listeners expect to hear when they walk into the lab, and then, of course, you know, they get attuned to the experiment, maybe, but this should closely approximate listeners' prior distributions. But there are some problems with using speech corpora as a prior, because if you look at this, well, these aren't exactly Gaussians. Yeah.
So this is all about English?
Yeah, so far all English. We chose it because it was actually what was used by Iverson and Kuhl in their original perceptual magnet effect work. So we, the quiet condition of our experiment was actually a replication of their experiment. But I would like to expand this to other vowels. Yeah. Right, so you do get some irresponses to a couple of these on the continuum if you give that option.
I guess what I'm saying is one could object that this is not an English response, it's a phonetic response. The EA difference, because you present them with two categories, but they're not distinguished from each other the way they are in speech.
Yeah, no, that's right. The A is not a natural A.
Right.
Despite that, we get people hearing A. So. It probably does. I don't know how yet.
What's the x-axis?
The x-axis, I wanted to wait to talk about that till later, but this is actually the second malfrequency Kepstrel coefficient. So this is just, you know, an illustrative histogram of the kind of data you find in speech data. But a challenge in using speech corpora as a prior is that sounds don't always fall neatly into Gaussian distribution, certainly not one Gaussian for every category. And so in our model, we had assumed that the prior distribution was a mixture of Gaussians with one Gaussian for every category. So that's going to be a problem for using speech corpora as a prior distribution in the model. And so the solution that we're going to use is to take samples from the prior distribution as a way of avoiding having to express the prior distribution in any sort of parametric form. So that is, we're not going to need to express the prior distribution as Gaussians. In fact, we're going to use a method where we can figure out what a listener would sample from a posterior distribution without knowing what the prior distribution was. All we have is samples from that prior distribution. So the method that we're going to use is called importance sampling. This is, if there are any cognitive scientists in here, this is the same, actually isomorphic with an exemplar model, so I'm going to use the word samples and exemplars interchangeably, and I just mean samples from the prior distribution. Important sampling goes like this. You have your prior distribution, so in this case I've drawn two Gaussians, but it doesn't have to be two Gaussians, and what we're going to do is represent that distribution using stored samples from that prior distribution, stored exemplars. And of course, these exemplars, so we can take, you know, a few of them. If you took the mean of these exemplars, you would get an approximation to the mean of the prior distribution. If you took one of them, you'd get a sample from the prior distribution, and so on. And you hear the stimulus, but actually these exemplars don't help, because what you want is not the mean of the prior and not a sample from the prior, but rather the mean of the posterior and a sample from the posterior, or a sample from the posterior. And so in order to make these exemplars behave as though they were drawn from the posterior distribution, what important sampling says is that we need to weight them by the ratio of the posterior distribution to the prior distribution. And Bayes' rule says that that's actually just the likelihood. And once you weight these exemplars by the likelihood, then they now behave as though they were drawn from the posterior distribution. So if you take their mean, that approximates the mean of the posterior distribution. That is, it's bias toward the more likely category. And if you say take one of them according to its weight, it behaves as though it were sampled from the posterior distribution. So this is important sampling, and it's what we're going to use to be able to implement our model on speech. So essentially, this provides a general way of approximating Bayesian inference, and in this case, what we're going to do is sample exemplars from our prior distribution. Those are just sounds, right? The prior is over target productions. Weight each exemplar by its likelihood, And then these weighted samples or exemplars are going to behave as though they were drawn from the posterior distribution, and we can figure out what a listener is going to say after hearing a sound. So what's nice about this is that we can actually use it with a prior that's not Gaussian. So let's say this is our nasty prior, but if we as long as we have samples from it, then what we can do is weight those samples by their likelihood after hearing a sound, and then just take their mean or take one of them as a sample, and that behaves as though it were sampled from the posterior. Yeah, it recovers your posterior. So given samples from the prior and some likelihood function that corresponds to the noise, we can predict how people are going to perceive experimental stimuli. And lucky for us, we have a pretty good approximation for people's prior of samples from people's prior distribution. That is, speech corpora actually contain samples of the speech that listeners have heard. So what we're going to do is use a speech corpus as a prior distribution, and we're going to assume the sounds in that corpus represent samples from that prior distribution. Right. So our AX trial in important sampling goes like this. So we can simulate an AX trial by starting with some distribution of sounds from a corpus. You know, we can take some of those exemplars, and we're going to make the model hear a stimulus. And upon hearing that stimulus, this model is going to weight the exemplars by their likelihood. And then it's going to sample one of those exemplars according to its weight. And then that sample will be the model's guess at what target production the speaker intended for this sound. Then for the second stimulus, they're going to hear a stimulus, weight exemplars by their likelihood, sample one of them, and then that's going to be the target production for the second stimulus. And so then the model can just compare the distance between those two samples. Now, these samples are all sounds from the corpus. So now we're computing the distance between two sounds in the corpus. And we can compare those to some threshold. And if it's lower than the threshold, the model will say same. And if it's higher than the threshold, the model will say different. And we can do this a lot of times and estimate the percentage of time that the model will say same to any particular trial. Right, so by simulating this AX trial a number of times, we can get a Monte Carlo estimate for the proportion of time that our model or a listener will respond to same to any given trial. And then we can just compare those percentages with human data. So for example, we can compute likelihoods on human data. Right. Okay, so here's a summary of what our method for working from corpus data. Essentially, we're going to assume that sounds in a corpus are sampled from a listener's prior distribution. And we're going to use those samples and a likelihood or noise function, which we're actually not going to change, that's going to stay Gaussian, to sample from listeners' posterior distributions for any given stimulus in the AX trial. We can use those samples to estimate a probability that with which listeners will say same to any given pair of stimuli, and we can compare that to human data. And so this will allow us to predict human data with a model that's using sounds from speech corpora. Okay, so that's our method. So we haven't gotten very far on this, and this is very much ongoing work that's mostly done by my research assistant, Caitlin Richter, and also in collaboration with Aaron Jensen. So we've got this method for implementing a model on speech, but we've still got a problem. I mean, how do we go about implementing it? And one kind of a problem is that you know, it was really nice when we could just use formant values or voice onset time because we knew what dimensions we were using. But actually, when you go to speech corpora, you can't go through and measure all the formant values, and you can't really go through and measure all the voice onset times. And anyway, it would be nice to have a single representation for all the sounds in a corpus. And so how should we represent this? So if you ask linguists, they'll sort of talk to you about formant frequencies and voice onset times. If you ask engineers, they might talk to you about things like PLPs or Rasta. The choice is actually kind of important because if the prior distribution is you know, some distribution of sounds that's biasing listeners' perception, those distributions might look different in these different dimensions. If distributions of sounds look different depending on which dimensions you use to represent the speech signal, then we can actually sort of flip this on its head and ask, well, can we make the model work with any set of dimensions, right? Like, maybe the model will work well with one set of dimensions and not so well with another set of dimensions. And so we're going to try this out. Eventually, we'd like to get to which features predict human data best, but we're going to start with a very simple case that we think we know the answer to, which is speaker normalization. We know that human listeners generalize across talkers. They do this in the lab. They do this in general. And we know that in automatic speech recognition, you can make a speech recognizer work better by normalizing vocal tract length across speakers. And in fact, in cognitive modeling, we also know that if you remove, say, speaker variability and other kinds of variability from the speech signal, you're able to predict human identification data better. And so we think that if we compare a normalized version of speech versus an unnormalized version, we're hoping to get a better match to human data by using the normalized version. And so the way the question that we're just going to test this paradigm is to ask, is there a benefit of vocal tract length normalization in predicting these human discrimination data from the experiment? And we're just going to use the very basic speech features that you all know and love and learned in third grade, MELF frequency Kestrel coefficients with and without vocal tract length normalization. Right, probably at least half of you know what these speech features are. I'm going to go through it anyway. What we do is we take the speech signal, we take a 25 millisecond window of it, and if you sort of turn this window on its head and look at which frequencies are represented in that waveform, you'll get something that looks like this, where this is the fundamental frequency, so the pitch of the utterance, and then you've got all the harmonics, and there are these broad peaks and dips in the spectrum. And so this is the first formant for vowels, this is the second peak is the second formant, and so on. And so what MFCCs do is they essentially take the low frequency components of that spectrum. And so if this was the original spectrum, they would represent something like this. Okay, so that's MFCCs. Vocal tract length normalization is essentially using the fact that men have longer vocal tracts than women, and so they tend to have lower frequencies when they're saying the same thing. And so what we're going to do is take the actual frequency, and if it's a man, we're going to expand that frequency linearly. If it's a woman, we're going to contract that frequency, so shrink it down. Just in a linear way. And so we can choose a warp factor for each speaker, and that's done in this case in an unsupervised way on the vowels. And so essentially what we're doing here is for men, we're going to sort of condense this frequency axis. For women, we're going to expand it. And then again, we're going to take the MFCCs from that spectrum. Okay, so in each of these cases, what we get out is this matrix of feature values, where in one dimension we've got the different frames, so those are time points of the signal. In the other dimension, we've got these different dimensions of the MEL frequency Kestrel coefficients. Speech people, please correct me if I say something wrong. Okay, we're ignoring actually the zeroth Kestrel coefficient, and that's because the stimuli were recorded in completely different conditions than the corpus we're using, which I'll talk about in a minute. And in addition, for these simulations I'll show you, although we don't want to keep doing this, we're only looking at the midpoint of each, in this case, vowel. So what we're going to do is, from our corpus, we'll use each vowel in the corpus as an exemplar. And from the stimuli, we'll use each of the 13 stimuli. And in each case, what we're going to do is take the midpoint frame, the middle frame of that vowel, and use it to represent our speech sounds. We'd like to move to using things over time. We're not there yet. So essentially, this is what the model is seeing for each exemplar and for each stimulus. So what we did was to compute this for each vowel in our corpus, which I'll tell you about in a minute, and for each stimulus. And we're going to simulate a listener using the normalized features and using the unnormalized features and just see which one works better. The corpus we're using is the Nationwide Speech Project, and the part of the corpus that we're using is just he'd, head, hud, had. So this is not naturalistic speech yet, but it's a little bit similar to the stimuli we have, which are isolated E, A. And so we're using 5 repetitions of 10 vowels from a bunch of dialect regions as a prior distribution in our model. So let me just show you what that looks like with the stimuli from our experiment and the vowels from the corpus in these different dimensions. So on the right, I have these raw MFCCs, and on the left, I have the raw, and on the right, I have the normalized MFCCs. And these triangles are the stimuli going from E to A in both cases. And then each dot is a vowel from the corpus. This is just MFCCs dimension 1 and 2. And so E's are in blue and A's are in pink and everything else is in gray. And so in dimensions 1 and 2, you can see that especially dimension 2 is separating these E's and A's. And so it's sort of hard to see what this normalization does to those distributions, so I'm gonna just show you dimension 2 here. So you can see that the distributions are a little bit peakier once they're normalized. They're a little bit better separated. There's not actually a huge difference. Okay, here's dimensions 3 and 4. You can also see that these stimuli sort of fall within the E's and A's, so that's good. In both the normal, actually a little bit better in the normalized features. Actually, once we get beyond 4, it's just bad news. So these dimensions aren't separating out the E's and A's from the other vowels, and the stimuli are just in random places. And we think that's a mismatch between the synthetic stimuli we're using and the corpus, the way it was recorded. So a 5 and 6 is giving us garbage. 7 and 8 is also giving us garbage. 9 and 10 is giving us garbage. 11 and 12 is giving us garbage. So actually, even though we have these 12 dimensions, in the simulations I'm going to show you, we're limiting ourselves to the first 4 dimensions. So we need to fit parameters for our simulation. We need a covariance matrix for the noise and a response threshold. Actually, we don't need any of the parameters of the prior distribution because we already have samples from our prior distribution. But we do have to fit this speech signal noise, which we're assuming is gonna be a Gaussian with a diagonal covariance matrix, and the response threshold, which is a parameter epsilon. We used Markov chain Monte Carlo to find those parameters. I'm not going to talk about it. I'm happy to answer questions. We used half of the exemplars in the corpus for fitting these parameters, and then we tested the fit on the other half of exemplars. And we actually used different speakers in each of the halves, but drawn from the same distribution, so it should be approximately the same distribution of sounds. So these were the results. So here I'm showing you the human data again. This was from the no noise condition. And on the right is the model fit using the parameters that we found as the best fit parameters. I'm not guaranteeing that our procedure converged perfectly, but we've run it several times, and the raw MFCCs actually always seem to have problems transferring to this new distribution of data. So you can see that it's getting some things right, so it's clustering the E's together, but it's also having trouble discriminating these sounds in the middle. So that's not like the humans.
This is
This is humans with no noise.
The model
is trained on the nationwide speech corpus, and that's clean as it can be. We don't of the categories. Yeah, so we actually don't need to find them here. So instead of using Gaussians as our prior distribution, what we're doing is assuming that the sounds in the corpus are sampled from the prior distribution. So actually, we never needed to find the centers. All we needed was the samples. And the reason for that is because we're computing the posterior through important sampling rather than by multiplying Gaussians together. I'm not sure if that helps. So let me show you the scatter plots again. So this is the E end of the stimulus continuum, and sorry, it's a little small. This is the A end. And then the blue dots are the E's in the corpus, and the pink dots are the A's. Actually, the model doesn't see those labels. It just sees the histogram of dots.
So where are the
A is the pink, the S. Yeah, they're somewhere in here. They're probably some of these gray dots. They're probably overlapping a lot with S, so I don't A, so I don't have them labeled explicitly, but they're in there.
And in an A, where
do you find the A is the pink dots here.
There's some automatic process for locating the vowel and
We don't get our parameters ever. So all we do is we use these histograms as samples from our prior distribution. And because we're using, and then we weight each of those samples by their similarity to the stimulus. And then we sample one of those sounds from the corpus according to its weight. And so in that procedure, there's never any finding the middle of the category. And the reason for that is because we've actually dropped the Gaussian assumption here. So all we need is for the prior distribution to be some distribution that we have samples from. Yeah. Yeah, and they're not here, are they?
So what do you actually do? I mean, how do you, in the next picture, you have the black and white confusion matrix.
Mm-hmm.
What constitutes equal steps in that?
Yeah, so let me go back to the stimuli. That I was very surprised when I saw how they were spaced in null space. So where are my stimuli? Okay, so here are the stimuli. So what Iverson and Kuhl did, and what we also did, was to convert the, to take a Mel scale and go in equal steps along the first formant and the second formant in that Mel scale. So that's formants along a Mel scale. Turns out when you take the discrete cosine transform of a speech, you know, when you compute the MFCCs, the stimuli are no longer equally spaced. So let me show you that again. And that was something that I hadn't realized before. So, you know, actually, I think that the E cluster here is an artifact of the fact that these are sort of bunched along this dimension. And in fact, the model is finding that these are also close together. And I think the reason is because they're bunched along this dimension. And so one of the problems that I think we have in this model is we've taken care not to overfit our exemplar distributions because we're training on one set of exemplars and testing on the other. We haven't actually been able to take care to not overfit our stimulus distributions because we only have this one experiment. So I'd really like to run some more experiments and be able to test the dimensions we're fitting. Yeah, so this was a piecewise linear function. So the
front cavity is this and back cavity like this. Which is your curve.
So my understanding is that all we're doing is a map is a linear mapping between the frequency that it actually is and the frequency. So the sure. Yeah, so this is what we're using. It's just a linear mapping. So it might be that as you change the vocal track length, that's right, but I think we're actually changing both. And not necessarily based on vocal track. So this is just based on how do we match the vowels from different speakers, right? Okay, so yeah, this was from raw MFCCs. We're actually doing a lot better with BTLN. So it seems like we can transfer distributions to our test exemplars without hurting the performance of the model. So we've got the same curviness, and we seem to have at least mostly gotten rid of this this cluster of stimuli in the middle. So in terms of likelihoods, we can compute model likelihoods on the human data. So these are the numbers we get. We've replicated a couple of times. These are sort of stably better with BTLN. And we can also compare it to our perceptual baseline. So in both of these cases, what we did was we took exemplars from the corpus as samples from our prior distribution. But before, we had run a simulation of these same data where we estimated the prior distribution based on perceptual identification data. So we can look at that. This was the picture that went along with that model fit. It's the same thing I showed you before. And it's actually doing better than anything we could estimate from speech corpora. So maybe we still don't have the right dimensions, or maybe we still don't have the right way that listeners are estimating their prior distributions. But we are getting this difference between this difference between different ways of representing the speech. And we're getting pretty close to how the model is doing trained on perceptual data. Of course, we have a lot more free parameters with. These are humans. And here, Gaussians estimated from perceptual identification data. So those were essentially people came into the lab and did an identification task. Based on that, we fit a logistic to that identification curve, and from that we could infer what the means of the categories were and what the variances were. And so that gives us sort of listeners' perceptual prior distributions, and we can estimate that without even sort of, so this is sort of cheating because we're using perceptual data to estimate perceptual parameters to then fit perceptual data, but that's what most cognitive models do. So we're trying to go a step further and use speech corpora to estimate prior distributions. It's this difference. It's this difference, and then this is the perceptual one. So, I mean, I think we're not doing as well as the perceptual data, pretty clearly. And I don't have error bars. So we do have error bars, but I do not have error bars with me here for this 255. But I'm willing to bet that this is reliably worse than when we just estimate people's perceptual parameters directly. But we can move things around by changing the way we represent the prior distribution of speech. So VTLN seems to improve the predictions, although it's still underperforming this prior distribution that was sort of cheating and estimated directly from perceptual data. But more broadly, essentially these differences that we're getting suggest that we may be able to develop this into something like an evaluation metric for different ways of representing the speech signal. So there's no reason that we have to limit ourselves to normalized and unnormalized MFCCs. If we think that people are using posteriorgrams, for example, we might be able to test those or anything like it. And in fact, it may be that no one's really come up with a good hypothesis yet about exactly what the perceptual dimensions that people are using are. In fact, those perceptual dimensions are very likely to differ between languages. And so if we're interested in answering that question, then this gives us a way of using perceptual data to evaluate whether we've got the right dimensions. So I'm out of time. So just to conclude, this was a model of speech perception. It was originally developed to mimic data in the lab, but by sort of working off of perceptual data and perceptual data, but we've tried, we've been working on developing methods to actually extend cognitive models to work in ecologically valid settings. In this case, the speech corpora provide the prior distribution, and then the perceptual data are what we think correspond to listeners' posterior distributions about what they're hearing. And so it's a model of speech perception that works in an ecologically valid setting. So it does all the things that it did before about predicting human data, but it also gives us sort of a window into what people are using to represent the speech signal. And so this is one way in which hopefully cognitive models can help because they actually provide an explicit link between human data and the things that we can measure in speech corpora, so that if we're interested in using human data to constrain the way we're representing speech, we really should be looking to cognitive models. Thanks. Yeah, so for the, no, it's not MFCCs. From the perceptual data, right, there are several things that are different between the original perceptual model and the one on speech corpora. So one is for the vowels, what we were using is formant space. So we were using that two-dimensional space that I showed you. Oh, you've got a microphone.
Oh. How do you think that this thing develops? I mean, you know, because or are people born with it, with mm-hmm. categorical perception, or animals, because animals also sometimes show that categorical perception when it is good for them.
Yeah.
Or advanced, you know?
So there are some data on that. We know that, for example, for stop consonants, animals and very young babies have find it easier to distinguish sounds that are simultaneous versus not simultaneous, which actually correspond pretty closely to the PBA distinction in English. That's not necessarily so true for vowels, although there is some evidence of sort of not exactly uniform discrimination. So at least something, I think, does come from auditory properties. And that's something that's been looked at a lot by researchers like Laurie Holt, for example, where her hypothesis is that, you know, characteristics of the auditory system actually shape the way that categories develop. And so that's why we have so many commonalities across different languages in which categories they're using, because some differences are just easier to hear. That said, I was very surprised when we were able to use, I was actually very surprised when Jakob and Emily were able to use this model to fit discrimination data. So this is a measure of discriminability here, so something like D prime. And this is a BPA continuum. These are data from Wood, you know, from 1976. But then the solid line is the model. And we're getting a pretty close fit. So because of the low variance of the B category that we inferred from identification data, we're actually getting lower discrimination of the Bs. I mean, this actually seems to fit consonant data really well without anything in the model that's accounting for differences in auditory sensitivity at different points along the continuum. And so I don't know what that means, but it seems to suggest that even if there are auditory discontinuities to start with, that the perceptual system might develop to just solve this problem of speech perception in a reasonable way, no matter what it started with. Yeah. Yeah.
I hear when you say this particular distinction, you actually aspirate B, so you say B per distinction. I assume it's because aspiration means nothing in English in terms of semantics. So does that mean that you only look for distinctions that actually carry semantic feature distinctions or features that carry semantic difference in that particular language?
Mm-hmm.
I assume in some languages B and P actually carry no semantic difference.
That's right.
And then I assume that discriminability would be different.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And it's potentially a problem for this model. And the reason is there are data, so I'll just cite one of them, which is Kazanina et al, 2006. So they tested Korean and Russian speakers. Let me make sure I get this right. So Korean does not have the distinction and Russian does. Sorry? Oh, Korean does have the distinction and Russian doesn't? But B and P, I see. But I think, okay, so Korean is the one that, one of the languages has this voicing distinction and one does not. And if anyone knows which one it is, please. So maybe Korean does and Russian doesn't.
Well, Russian definitely has a voice distinction.
Okay.
And it doesn't have aspirations.
So in one of them, it's allophonic. They actually all have both sounds, but in one of them, it's phonemic, and in one of them, it's allophonic. So in your terminology, in one of them, it makes a semantic difference, and in the other one, it's just depending on which position it is in the word. And what they found is that when it makes a semantic difference, if you play people, you know, ba 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 pa pa pa. If you play people a continuum, the one where it makes a semantic difference will have this peak in discrimination. The one where it doesn't make a semantic difference will not have the peak in discrimination. Okay, so that's problematic for this model because this model only works on distributions. And so one way of sort of dealing with that is actually we need to make a more complex model. A second potential way of dealing with that would be to say that actually in the case where it doesn't make a semantic difference. The two allophones, so the two sounds, are always heard in different contexts. So actually, if you look in the context that you're listening in, actually there's a unimodal distribution there. It's just one sound. And so we don't have then the kind of distribution that would pull sounds apart because it's just all unimodal. And so I think that's still an open question, sort of what's making it hard to discriminate allophones. And it's hard to test because you always hear allophones in different contexts. But in order to do a good laboratory experiment, you need to play them in the same context because otherwise they're trivial to discriminate. Thanks, guys.